Imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence-seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office, a decision that the prime minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu.
Mm-hmm.
The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December the 1st, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sauté. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies, and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger, and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In the US, a key witness has told the House Select January 6th committee that a lawyer linked to Donald Trump tried to silence her. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered this story. The Trump-aligned lawyer who initially represented former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson instructed her to downplay her knowledge of what happened during the Capitol insurrection. Cassidy Hutchinson told the House Select January 6th committee in testimony made public on Thursday, 22nd of December. "We're going to downplay your role," attorney Stephen Passatino told Hutchinson, according to her testimony. "You were a secretary. The less you remember, the better." The details of the apparent Trump World pressure campaign on one of the committee's key witnesses were among a number of revelations and a handful of deposition transcripts the committee made public on Thursday, 22nd of December. The panel's final report, the closing salvo of its 18-month-long investigation, has not yet been released. Cassidy Hutchinson parted ways with Stephen Passatino after several Spring 2021 appearances before the committee, in which she felt she was giving untruthful or incomplete answers, she said. After switching attorneys, she provided some of the most dramatic live testimony of the panel's 9 hearings this year. According to Hutchinson, Passatino did not want her to tell the committee that former President Donald Trump had lunged at his security detail when they refused to take him to the Capitol during the riot on 6th of January 2021. Hutchinson felt she had no other option but to retain the Trump-aligned lawyer because she couldn't afford to pay the high costs of other attorneys she contacted while seeking representation, she told the committee in 2 days of depositions back in September. Stephen Passatino would not tell her who was paying for his legal services, Hutchinson told the committee, and she soon became leery, suspecting he was more concerned about Donald Trump and other high-ranking former White House officials than he was about her. "I'm completely indebted to these people," she recalled telling her mother. "I was like, and they will ruin my life, Mum, if I do anything that they don't want me to do." Passatino encouraged her to downplay her role as one of former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' most trusted aides, she said, and urged her to answer questions with the phrase, "I cannot recall," even when she had clear memories of what had happened. Cassidy Hutchinson said Stephen Passatino and others in Donald Trump's orbit, including Mark Meadows, through an intermediary, kept reminding her to be loyal and repeatedly spoke of finding her a well-paid job after her interviews with the committee. "We just want to focus on protecting the president. We all know you're loyal," Hutchinson said, Passatino told her. In a statement first reported by CNN, Passatino said he represented Hutchinson as he had other clients honorably, ethically, and fully consistent with her sole interests as she communicated them to me. Also released on Thursday, 22nd of December, were transcripts of the committee's interviews with Chris Krebs, former director of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Convicted January 6 rioter Stephen Ayers, former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Justice Department employee Ken Kulikowski, and Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary. Ken Kulikowski, whose transcript shows he told the committee he could not recall the answer to most of their questions, has connections to some of the most influential players in the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The Associated Press has also covered the same story. Former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson described to the House January 6 committee a wide-ranging pressure campaign from Donald Trump's allies aimed at influencing her cooperation with Congress and stifling potentially damaging testimony about Trump. In extraordinary closed-door testimony made public on Thursday, 22nd of December, Cassidy Hutchinson recounted how those in the former president's circle dangled job opportunities and financial assistance as she was cooperating with the committee investigating the Capitol riot, and how her own lawyer, a former ethics counsel in the Trump White House, advised her against being fully forthcoming with lawmakers and told her, "The less you remember, the better." The 9-member committee released 2 never-before-seen transcripts of Hutchinson's testimony as it tries to wrap up its investigation and make its work public. The committee, which will dissolve when Republicans take over the House of Representatives on 3rd of January, was also expected to release its final report on Thursday. The transcripts provide previously unknown details about what Cassidy Hutchinson called the moral struggle, torn between the desire to speak the truth and to remain loyal to Donald Trump, that she says she endured on the way to becoming one of the most memorable witnesses of the committee's investigation. In a televised hearing back in June, Hutchinson went public about Donald Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021. She described his directive that magnetometers be removed from a rally of his supporters on that day and detailed his angry and ultimately rebuffed demands to be taken by the Secret Service to the Capitol to join the crowd trying to disrupt the congressional certification of Joe Biden's election victory. "In my mind, this whole time, I felt this moral struggle," she said. According to the transcript, she described a first interview with the committee in which she concealed testimony about Donald Trump that, months later, she would deliver to a rapt hearing room. "Looking back now," she said, "it feels ridiculous because in my heart I knew where my loyalties lied, and my loyalties lied with the truth. And I never wanted to diverge from that. You know, I never wanted or thought that I would be the witness that I have become, because I thought that more people would be willing to speak out to." But to hear her tell it, the testimony was never a sure thing. Like other aides whose proximity to Donald Trump entangled them in investigations, Cassidy Hutchinson scrambled to find a lawyer after receiving a subpoena from the committee last year. Former White House officials and Trump allies worked to line up a lawyer for her, despite her own discomfort at being represented by someone in Trump world, an affiliation she feared would make her indebted to these people. She said she was contacted in February by Stephen Passantino, a former White House ethics counsel who told her he would be her lawyer. He said she would not have to pay for his services, but demurred when she asked from where the money was coming. She later learned that it was from Trump allies.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today. Tunisia is still in political turmoil even after the recent parliamentary election, with the main opposition coalition calling on President Kais Saied to step down following an extremely low voter turnout. Politicians are now claiming that the country is back to square one in terms of democracy.
We are all now back to square one. Over the last 10 years, freedom prevailed over each corner of the country, and each one of you had the liberty to express himself completely, freely move, and to freely listen, to run in elections, and to freely vote. We were among the developed democratic states in the last 10 years, and this fact cannot be denied.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the fluid political situation in Tunisia after the country's parliamentary election, with the opposition insisting that the low voter turnout practically left the head of state without legitimacy. The second part of the show will be on continued protests in Morocco against the kingdom's normalization with the Israeli regime. Moroccans also led the world in voicing solidarity with Palestine during the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analyses. And you can also be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Tunisia after elections. Tunisia's December 17 parliamentary election, the first since Tunisian President Kais Saied took over most powers in July 2021, recorded the lowest electoral turnout in its recent history. The country's main opposition alliance called on Saied to leave immediately, as voters overwhelmingly snubbed the legislative election in what officials at the country's Elections Commission said was a participation rate of 8.8%.
Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis that aggravated the country's economic conditions since 2021, when President Kais Saied ousted the government and dissolved parliament. While the Tunisian president insists that his measures were meant to save the country, critics have accused him of orchestrating a coup. Secretary General of the Republican Party, Issam Chebbi, elaborates here on why they boycotted the last elections.
We decided to boycott the upcoming elections. This move is in response to an electoral law written by Saied alone, part of a coup against constitutional legitimacy.
Now, for more on the political situation in Tunisia, we have contacted Sami Hamdi. He's the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, what was the reason for the historically low turnout during Tunisia's last parliamentary election?
I think when it comes to the historically low turnout, I think what's important to note is that all the Tunisians knew that these elections were not about trying to establish a new mandate. They were not about trying to establish a new legitimacy for Kais Saied. The opposition parties were prevented from running. Many candidates were prevented from running. And everybody essentially believed that these elections would not be free and fair, that it was a way for Kais Saied simply to try to close the chapter on the parliament that he suspended and to essentially offer an avenue for international recognition of his toppling of the constitution and the suspension of parliament. So for the people, for the Tunisian people, they knew that these elections were not for them. They knew these elections were not about change. They knew these elections were not about asking them who they want to rule, but rather it was simply an orchestrated show designed to try to give this image of democracy rather than actually implementing democracy. And this is why Tunisians stayed away, because they believe that irrespective of whether they voted or not, it would not make any impact whatsoever.
Saied, a former law professor who was a political independent when elected president in 2019, dissolved the previous parliament. He started ruling by decree in July 2021, gradually amassing more power. In 2020, the president put a new constitution to vote that entered into force so he could overhaul the country's electoral system. President Saied has defended these decisions, underscoring that the country had been on the verge of a civil war. The Tunisian president also defended last December's election as an important step towards a fully fledged democracy.
This is your historic moment. Don't miss the opportunity. Vote so you can get back your legitimate rights for justice and freedom.
However, the country's main opposition alliance is demanding that President Saeed resigns, claiming because voters overwhelmingly snubbed the legislative election.
I think that when it comes to opposition calls for Kais Saied to leave, I think what's important to note is that these elections were never about the Tunisian people. The reason Kais Saied held these elections was not for the Tunisian audience or not even for to renew legitimacy domestically. The whole purpose of the elections in Kais Saied's eyes was to offer an avenue for the international community to recognize his seizure of power, to recognize his new authority. A lot of the statements have been focused on restoring a democratic process, according to the various statements. What Kais Saied wanted was to offer an avenue through which the international community could say with a straight face that we see a democratic process in Tunisia. And Kais Saied achieved this, and we can see that in the White House statement that came out following the elections, which welcomed the elections as a step towards restoring the democratic process, despite the low turnout. So the opposition calling for Kais Saied to leave, I think it's important to note that the elections were never about Tunisians. It was never about renewing legitimacy. It was never about securing a mandate from the people. It was entirely about presenting an avenue through which Washington and the EU could turn around and say, we can now close the chapter on the parliament that was suspended because elections were held, however dubious they might be. And now we can work with Kais Saied and now we can recognize his authority. And if this was the aim of Kais Saied, then he succeeded. So it's irrelevant what the opposition says, at least according to Kais Saied.
The critics of President Saeed insist that the objective of the dissolution of parliament was consolidating a system of government run by one person with absolute power. However, Saeed has presented his actions as not only legal but necessary to save Tunisia.
Unfortunately, we are witnessing a coup attempt, but it is a failed one. The national duty requires today the protection of all the people and the homeland based on the articles of the constitution.
President Saeed says all his actions have been taken for the interests of Tunisians. Do you agree?
I think when it comes to whether Kais Saied has been acting in the interests of Tunisia, whether he believes he is acting in the interests of Tunisia, I do think that this is a much more complicated question, primarily because Kais Saied, since he won the presidential election in 2019, a landslide election, bear in mind that he won the landslide because the Tunisians were rejecting the other candidate as opposed to supporting Kais Saied. Nabil Karoui, the other candidate, was considered associated with corruption, and though so Tunisians wanted to vote against him rather than for Saied. But irrespective, Saeed from day one made it absolutely clear that he wanted to rule the country directly. And in a country where the constitution makes parliament supreme and essentially doesn't give many powers to the president, this frustrated Kais Saied. And so he was in an open wrestling match with the parliament from day one in trying to appoint his own prime ministers while parliament was trying to appoint their own prime ministers. So I think there has been this wrestling. So the point being is that all of these measures that we've seen that are being taken have been primarily about Kais Saied seizing that power for himself, trying to essentially dominate the political scene.
Early January, a massive strike over pay by transport workers crippled transport in the Tunisian capital. The strike, the latest in a series of similar actions, came as the North African nation is currently struggling with debts of over 100% of the gross domestic product. Tunisia is also embroiled with a severe economic crisis amid frequent shortages of basic goods from petrol to cooking oil.
The reality is the economy is still spiraling. There are no policies that have brought about any particular change in the status quo in Tunisia, whether that's politically or economically. We've seen inflation, we've seen greater crises one after the other, we've seen the annihilation of the democratic process, and we see an increasing population that is increasingly despairing, and the numbers of those trying to cross what are called the boats of death across the Mediterranean are increasing. So therefore, when we talk about the interest of Tunisia, if Kais Saied was intending to defend and protect the interest of Tunisia, then he's certainly failing miserably. If his intention was to seize power for himself and dominate, he certainly seized power and he's certainly dominating. And the reality is that the situation now is worse than it has ever been.
The Tunisian president last July refuted any form of foreign meddling, affirming that Tunisia is a free, independent and sovereign country. He also extended from January 1st for 1 month the state of emergency in place since 2015.
Now, why did the government of Tunisia extend the state of emergency again this month?
In terms of the state of emergency, I think it's important to highlight that Kais Saied knows that the economic situation is really bad at the moment. It's spiraling out of control. And Kais Saied now is realizing that the Tunisian population are having limited patience with him. And this is why we've seen moves in which he's sacked his trade minister as a result of the inflation, as a result of prices, as a result of the failure of tackling the economic crisis. There have been general strikes by the trade unions who supported his overthrow of the parliament and constitution, but who are clashing with him because they want to lead the process or the next stage as opposed to following Kais Saied. With the economy now really struggling, Kais Saied has declared a state of emergency as he tries to seek to maintain control and avoid any outburst of protest or any outburst of discontent that might threaten his rule or undermine his rule. So the state of emergency is primarily about preserving Kais Saied's power amidst this very difficult situation, which could well see, if there is any comparison with 2011, we're seeing in 2011 people took to the streets as a result of the economic crisis. Kais Saied fears that if he doesn't crack down on dissent very hard and doesn't take measures in order to prevent any gatherings, then it may well be that Tunisians will come out in the streets against him, not necessarily to restore the opposition, but just in this burst of rage that Kais Saied promised to make things better, and he hasn't.
Well, it's quite clear that the political situation in Tunisia remains fluid. We shall keep you posted as events unfold in this North African country. And we now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the uprising by Moroccans against the decision by the country's monarchy to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Stay with us.
Moroccans showdown with monarchy over Palestine.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Moroccan fans are seen here reaffirming their support for Palestine after their country's team claimed a thrilling victory over Belgium at the World Cup. To discuss the growing movement of Moroccans opposed to normalization of ties with the Israeli apartheid regime, we have contacted Abbas Hamideh, a Palestinian activist and commentator. He's also the founder of Al Auda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, during the just concluded FIFA World Cup in Qatar, Moroccan players and fans became famous for raising the Palestinian flag in solidarity with oppressed Palestinians. Why is supporting Palestine important for Moroccans?
Well, I think there's been a long history with the Moroccan people in general, and of course, Moroccan teams and Al-Maghrib Al-Arabi in general, who support the Palestinian struggle. So this is a very close bond that the Moroccan people have always had for the Palestinian people, you know, whether inside Morocco and even outside of Morocco. For example, when I hold rallies in Washington, D.C., we have a lot of Moroccan people from the Moroccan community in D.C. who come out. I think it's a very powerful statement. It's a solidarity that they've always had And historically, I mean, the Moroccans came with Salah ad-Din to liberate Palestine, during the Salah ad-Din era. So I think there's a very strong connection, with the Moroccan people for Palestine.
Morocco's journey to the semifinals of the FIFA World Cup in Qatar is not just viewed as a national victory, but one for Africa and the entire Arab world, and in particular, a major boost for Palestinians. A Moroccan fan speaks here on the importance of players and fans raising the Palestinian flag.
Palestine's flag means a lot, especially at Qatar's World Cup. Here we feel that we can send the whole world a message, which is that Palestine will one day be free.
Despite the massive support for Palestine by Moroccans during the World Cup, the monarchy in Rabat is adamant on pushing the normalization agenda with the Israeli regime. The monarchy in Morocco is clearly bent on ignoring the voice of the masses.
Yeah, this is a very unfortunate situation where the monarchy or the kingdom of Morocco has always had ties, to the Zionist entity occupying Palestine. I think this is, on a personal perspective, that's something very shameful of the Moroccan government to do, doing that. They've always had ties with the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and that's very unfortunate. But I think just like some other Arab governments or even some Muslim governments, unfortunately, the government does not represent its people, especially on Palestine. So while they're trying to continuously normalize with the Israeli occupation, that's something that's very shameful. And their people obviously do not reflect normalization. And we saw that at FIFA, at the World Cup, where Morocco obviously, the Moroccan team, gloriously represented Palestine. They carried the Palestinian flag, over their flag.
Moroccan fans led the world, and especially the Arab world, in raising the Palestinian flag during the World Cup in Qatar. A soccer fan from England who joined the movement led by Moroccans to raise the flag of Palestine speaks here on the reason for his solidarity with Palestinians.
Well, look, in this day and age, you shouldn't bring politics into sport. I agree with that. Not the players, not the football itself. But I think we, as individuals, have a right to freedom of expression. And this is a great opportunity to show our solidarity with the Palestinian people.
How did the support for Palestinian liberation by football fans from across the world impact on the public opinion in Arab countries regarding the unpopular normalization deals being pursued by some Arab regimes?
Yes, absolutely. I think it reflected very well. It was a slap in the face to quite frankly, the United Arab Emirates in general, who continuously normalize, with the Israeli occupation. I think that was a clear message from the Moroccan team. Also the fans, the Moroccan fans, fans from all over the world, quite frankly, not just Morocco, who were there waving the Palestinian flag. So I think that was a clear statement that the Moroccan people do not basically agree with their government. And it was a slap in the face to the United Arab Emirates in general, who obviously is normalizing with the Israeli occupation. So I think this was something courageous. I think this is something that reflects Arabs on the ground and not their government. So this was a slap in the face to all of them, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, to any Arab government that's seeking to normalize with Israel. This was a clear-cut slap in the face.
Morocco agreed in 2020 to normalize ties with the illegal Israeli entity under the so-called Abraham Accords that were brokered by the United States. As part of the deal, and in a departure from long-standing U.S. policy, then-President Donald Trump agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara region.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa last year hosted Western Sahara President Brahim Ghali in Pretoria. During the visit, he stated that until the people of Western Sahara are able to exercise their right to self-determination, the decolonization of Africa will be incomplete.
Until the people of Western Sahara are able to exercise their own right to self-determination, the decolonization of Africa will be incomplete. As a country whose freedom was attained with the assistance of the international community and international support and solidarity, South Africa stands with the Sahrawi people in their struggle for self-determination.
The U.S. recognition of Rabat's claim over Western Sahara as the political border between Rabat and Washington led to the normalization with Tel Aviv.
I think it's going to prove futile, no matter what the Moroccan government seeks. And, you know, they're always extending their arms out. You know, we're talking about the leadership here and not the people. Whether they're extending their hands out to normalizing with the Israeli occupation, or whether they're extending their hand out to the United States for political gain and basically a green light from the United States as far as continuing to occupy the Western Sahara. It's going to prove futile because, you know, on the ground, it's a different story. There is a long-standing history between Morocco and the United States. I mean, the first country in the world to basically recognize the United States as a government was Morocco. So they have a long-standing history with each other. Unfortunately, the governments are corrupt in this case, you know, unlike their people. So I do believe that it will definitely collapse. It does not represent what's going on the ground. I do believe that in general, the Moroccan people stand with their brother in the Western Sahara.
The rift between the people of Morocco and the ruling monarchy is getting wider over the monarchy's normalization deal with the Israeli regime. A Moroccan speaks here during a protest to oppose his country ties with Israel.
This march today and all these demonstrations of the Palestinians is supported by several free movements around the world, in Europe, Latin America, the United States and Africa. This normalization must be stopped in our country.
Now, do you foresee the rift between the ruling monarchy and majority of Moroccans widening further until the normalization agreement with the Israeli regime is revoked?
Absolutely. I do see a rift widening between the Moroccan people on the ground and their governments, especially over Palestine, because it is not what the people wish. The people are, in general, you know, anti-colonization of Palestine. They're anti-normalizing with the Israeli occupation. And I think that the Moroccan people are ashamed of their government. I mean, I speak from firsthand experience with Moroccan friends, you know, who attend my rallies here in the United States. And they are definitely not happy with their government, you know, with their continued relationships between the government of Morocco and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. So it is only natural that that's going to widen. And it's only natural that eventually it will lead to mass protests. And that's what we hope for. We hope for all people, you know, around the world, in every Arab country, not just Morocco. But we are proud of the Moroccan people. We are proud of the Moroccans on the ground who do hold one of the largest protests for Palestine.
Well, there you have it. The rift between the people of Morocco and the ruling monarchy is set to widen and lead to more mass protests against the normalization deal with the Israeli regime. I'd like to thank our guest, Abbas Hamide, for his analysis today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Arctic is getting rainier and seasons are shifting, with broad consequences for people, ecosystems, and wildlife. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, "In the Arctic, the freedom to travel, hunt, and make day-to-day decisions is profoundly tied to cold and frozen conditions for much of the year. These conditions are rapidly changing as the Arctic warms. The Arctic is now seeing more rainfall when historically it would be snowing. Sea ice that once protected coastlines from erosion during fall storms is forming later. And thinner river and lake ice is making travel by snowmobile increasing life-threatening. Ship traffic in the Arctic is also increasing, bringing new risks to fragile ecosystems, and the Greenland ice sheet is continuing to send fresh water and ice into the ocean, raising global sea level. In the annual Arctic report card released on December 13, 2022, some scientists were brought together to examine the current state of the Arctic system. It was found that Arctic precipitation is on the rise across all seasons, and these seasons are shifting. Much of this new precipitation is now falling as rain, sometimes during winter and traditionally frozen times of the year. This disrupts daily life for humans, wildlife, and plants. Roads become dangerously icy more often, and communities face greater risk of river flooding events. For indigenous reindeer herding communities, winter rain can create an impenetrable ice layer that prevents their reindeer from accessing vegetation beneath the snow. Arctic-wide, this shift toward wetter conditions can disrupt the lives of animals and plants that have evolved for dry and cold conditions, potentially altering Arctic people's local foods. When Fairbanks, Alaska, got 1.4 inches of freezing rain in December 2021, the moisture created an ice layer that persisted for months, bringing down trees and disrupting travel. Infrastructure and the ability of some Arctic animals to forage for food. The resulting ice layer was largely responsible for the deaths of a third of a bison herd in interior Alaska. There are multiple reasons for this increase in Arctic precipitation. As sea ice rapidly declines, more open water is exposed, which feeds increased moisture into the atmosphere. The entire Arctic region has seen a more than 40% loss in summer sea ice extent over the 44-year satellite record. The Arctic atmosphere is also warming more than twice as fast as the rest of the globe, and this warmer air can hold more moisture. Under the ground, the wetter rain near Arctic is accelerating the thaw of permafrost, upon which most Arctic communities and infrastructure are built. The result is crumbling buildings, sagging and cracked roads, the emergence of sinkholes and the collapse of community coastlines along rivers and ocean. Wetter weather also disrupts the building of a reliable winter snowpack and safe, reliable river ice, and often challenges indigenous communities' efforts to harvest and secure their food. When Typhoon Merbak hit in September 2022, fueled by unusually warm Pacific water, its hurricane-force winds, 50-foot waves, and far-reaching storm surge damaged homes and infrastructure over 1,000 miles of Bering Sea coastline and disrupted hunting and harvesting at a crucial time. Snow plays critical roles in the Arctic, and the snow season is shrinking. Snow helps to keep the Arctic cool by reflecting incoming solar radiation back to space, rather than allowing it to be absorbed by the darker, snow-free ground. Its presence helps lake ice last longer into spring and helps the land to retain moisture longer into summer, preventing overly dry conditions that are ripe for devastating wildfires. Snow is also a travel platform for hunters